Good afternoon. My name is Dennis Walcott, and I have the honor of being the president of the Queens Public Library. And it is my pleasure to welcome all of you today to this very important discussion on something that is very troubling to all of us, and we need to make sure we continue to speak out, and that's what today is about. And as a result of some of the leadership, both in Washington, here in New York, we have a number of groups that have organized, have been speaking out, but we always still need to do more. And the Queens Public Library is here to work with our community partners and our elected officials to see how we can be helpful as well. So with that being said, I know that several of our speakers have very tight schedules. And so I will start with our DA, who I know is on an extremely tight, and then we'll go straight to our congresswoman, and then we'll open it up to the panel from there. So with that being said, it's my honor and pleasure to welcome our DA, our former borough president of Queens, major supporter of the Queens Public Library, to talk about the topic for today. But again, I want to thank you for your ongoing leadership for not just the library, but people of Queens and the city of New York and throughout the country. My pleasure to introduce the DA, Melinda Katz. Madam DA?
Thank you, Dennis. Can you hear me?
We can.
Great. It is so great to see you again, Mr. Walcott. Thank you for your leadership on the library. Thank you for the work that you do in our great diverse county of Queens County. It is a real service that the library presents to our borough, and I thank you for your leadership. To Congresswoman Meng, who really, we have been doing so many Zooms together about anti-Asian hate crimes and anti-Asian crimes in general. It's not just about hate crimes. It's about the culture change. It's about the fact that in the last year in the city, crimes against Asian populations have increased. And make no mistake about it, Mr. Walcott, in the last 5 years in the United States of America, the crimes against the Asian community has increased nationwide. And so it's an issue that we all take seriously. I want to thank the Congresswoman and the library for hosting this program. On the call with me today is Michael Brobner. Michael Brobner is the Bureau Chief of Hate Crimes for the Borough of Queens. It is the first Bureau Chief of a Hate Crimes Bureau, its own standing bureau in the city of New York. I want to thank him for his leadership, and he will stay on the call, maybe to answer questions later if you have them in the chat, or just to be present for any issues or complaints or anything that you might want to share. I'm here today just to talk about the fact that we can combat this trend, and we need to work together to do it. And I want to make it very clear, when one group is suffering in the borough of Queens County, we all are. It is our strength. Our diversity is the gift that we give the rest of the United States of America. And we do it every single day. And in order to combat these hate crimes and crimes against the Asian community in general, by the way, we need to make sure that we work together. We need members of the community to report the crimes in real time, as they're taking place or shortly thereafter. When you report a hate crime, I just want to make sure that you know this. The chance of the perpetrator being caught is increased. The sooner the police can gather evidence, the stronger the case. So much evidence can be time sensitive, like surveillance videos and cell phone records and witness accounts. And it's so important to gather them as soon as we possibly can. And by the way, I want to make sure that everyone knows this. Anyone can report a crime. Anyone can be a witness and or a victim who reports crime. We will never ask about documentation status. We will never report to the federal government. And we want everyone to know that the district attorney's office is a safe place to report anything that might have happened to you. During the first 100 days of my administration, like I said, I created the Hate Crime Bureau because I believed so deeply about it. And I want to just explain, when we say an incident against an Asian victim, even if it's not deemed to be a hate crime, even if it's not targeted solely because of ethnic background or because where folks are from, the language they speak, who they love, anything like that, that calls it a hate crime. We will prosecute if the underlying crime is credible to prosecute. And it's important that people know that. But we can only do it if we know that it's happening and we have witnesses that step forward. At the same time, you're not going to prosecute your way out of this. This is about change in our culture. This is about making sure we educate. This is about having a community partnerships division like I have. Colleen Babb is also on this webinar to make sure that there's community engagement, that, I have advisory councils from all over the borough, from almost every religion, ethnic background, to make sure that we cross, people that are celebrating, for instance, Lunar New Year or Ramadan, that we're inviting all of our advisory councils to that, so that folks are learning each and every day about each other's culture and traditions. And that is the power of Queens County. And it's also the power of the public library. The fact that you have targeted the communities for the language and the books that they would like to read in the languages that are represented in the community, that you have newspapers that are from different countries, I think is an amazing tribute to the Queens Library. So thank you for allowing me to say a few words. I would like Michael Brodner or Dennis, I will have someone put in the chat the hate crimes number. It's a hotline, 24/7, people can call. And please, anyone who needs our assistance, please reach out. Thank you to the Queens Library for the work you do.
And thank you, Madam DA. We're on the same page. So I was going to say, one of the things we can do as a follow-up is to make sure we include that number in our material as well as posting it on our website. So people after these sessions will be able to know where to go and who to turn to. So Madam DA, thank you for your leadership and we appreciate it, and all the best to you.
My pleasure.
And with that, I'd like to bring up next our great Congresswoman, who has been a major leader in this process of discussion, leadership, action, legislation, and taking us to the next level. And that's Congresswoman Grace Meng. And the Congresswoman has been very both generous to the Queens Public Library in so many ways, but more importantly, her words, her actions, her basic desire to do good has been a tremendous, tremendous thing. But not just the borough of Queens and not just for New York City or state, but for the country as a whole. So Congresswoman, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, President Walcott, for your kind introduction and for you and the entire Queens Public Library team for the tremendous resources and source of comfort that your team has provided to not just our borough, but to the city of New York during this really tough time for us here in Queens. As you all know, Queens really was the epicenter of the epicenter for over this past year. And we've missed our libraries and at the same time have so appreciated on behalf of my constituents these centers of whether it's testing or vaccination, so many additional roles that the library has taken on during this tough time to be there for our communities and to literally help save lives. To DA Katz, thank you for your leadership and thank you for always seizing every opportunity to stand up publicly and in solidarity with our AAPI community and all communities across the borough. I'm honored to be here with my fellow panelists and thank them so much for the hard work that they do every single day. I know that this past year has really been a really challenging year for our communities here in Queens, specifically for the Asian American community, not just enduring this pandemic and quarantine, but also this additional virus of hatred and discrimination. I also want to take this opportunity as we work and live in probably one of the most diverse counties in the entire country, I want to take a moment to say thank you. I have never in my entire life as a Queens girl felt so much love, support, and encouragement from so many people from way beyond the Asian American community. Our community is so heartened by the tremendous showing of allyship and solidarity from so many different communities. And we are so thankful. you know, as an Asian American kid growing up here in Queens, as a daughter of immigrants, I probably share so many similar experiences as other Asian Americans. You know, people making fun of our eyes, our food, our traditions, people asking us where we learned English, telling us constantly to go back to wherever we came from, even though I was born right here in Queens. And many of us have felt that the Asian American community has either been seen as invisible and silent or treated as foreigners and outsiders. And in the last few months, we've seen so many of these incidents happen to people across the country, but especially painful is to watch these incidents happen to our elderly, people who look like they could be our parents, our grandparents. And it's been really heartbreaking. And so I just wanted to be here to say thank you to each and every one of you for caring enough to provide this space to participate here today as we come together, not just in solidarity, but to be productive and constructive. I want to make sure that we are moving as a borough with our great diversity in one direction with solidarity. I want to make sure that we are never pointing fingers at any communities, and that we are never just placing blame on other communities, but finding ways on how we can work together. As a Queens community, we have marched against anti-Semitism together. We have marched and spoken out for Black lives in this country. And now we stand and are so thankful for so many community members who are standing up with our Asian American community. So I look forward to having this discussion and how we can continue to move forward and progress and to keep all of our communities safe.
So Congresswoman, I know you have a busy schedule. I'm going to bring the panel on in a second, but if I can, I wanted to ask you one question. For people who are obviously outraged by what's taking place, but really don't know what to do with their concerns and their anger as far as the attacks against the AAPI community, what one or two things would you say to people who are out there say, I really want to do something constructive? What would that be?
So there's actually a really wide spectrum, and I won't get into everything, a wide spectrum of ways that people can help, right? Some people like to learn about and participate in what we've been hearing a lot about, bystander or upstander trainings, and not necessarily that you have to get physically involved, but what you could even say to help distract a situation that might be going on. And, you know, some people are working to push legislation at different levels of government, pushing for legislation, pushing for resources and funding for our community groups who are literally on the front lines of protecting our community members. But you know what? One of the most basic ways and one of the most touching ways that I have felt during this time when people ask how they can help is just to see us and to include us. I was born and raised in this country, but I've been in so many rooms, so many meetings where Asian Americans are not mentioned, are not referenced to, and completely left out of the conversation. From our history books to our budget books, we are often completely left out. And so just to see us and include us in your stories and recognize that we are Americans too, and our history is just as American as anyone else is incredibly impactful.
So as you know, I think we've been doing at the library are also bystander standard type of training in multiple languages as well. And we've had good response. And then tomorrow we're going to do a major staff training as well. So we're having an all staff meeting on the empowerment of our staff and working with our team to make sure they're active participants in this discussion. So we're taking a look at how we broaden our net and thus the panel tonight. And with your leadership, the DA's leadership, and the leadership of our panel members and others, we are here to work with the community to make sure we are supporting, educating, informing, and playing the role of a library and having material available for people as well. So I want to thank you for everything and your leadership. And if you can stay, that's fine. But we also understand you have a lot going on as well. So I'm going to introduce the panel now, and then we'll enter into our discussion. So with that, let me start by reading a brief part of their bios. And Sapnavi Raj is the Deputy Commissioner of Law Enforcement Bureau at the New York City Commission on Human Rights. The Bureau has 45 attorneys who investigate claims of discrimination pursuant to the New York City Human Rights Law in employment, housing, and public accommodations. She is also responsible for the affirmative investigations and litigations the Commission initiates. Prior to the Commissioner, the Deputy Commissioner headed the Fair Housing Center at the Memphis Area Legal Services, supervising fair housing litigation in federal court. We're also joined by Joyce Boy, who is the Executive Director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute at CUNY, which supports, facilitates, and disseminates and conducts research on issues of importance concerning Asian Americans and global Asian communities. Joyce is taught at Queens College, Cornell University School of Law, SUNY School of Law. She's a former practicing attorney and is an advisor to the Queens Borough President's General Assembly and a member of the University Advisory Council on Diversity for the City University of New York. And then we're joined also by Jennifer Sun, who is the co-executive director of Asian Americans for Equality, which advances racial, social, and economic justice for Asian Americans and other disadvantaged communities. She joined the organization after more than a decade at the New York City government advancing economic development and large-scale infrastructure projects in Upper Manhattan, the South Bronx, Southwestern Brooklyn, and also worked at the city's Parks Department, where she led the implementation of the city's Community Parks Initiative. She also managed Rebuild Chinatown Initiative at AAFE, organizing the local stakeholders to advocate post 9/11 public investments in Chinatown's economy and infrastructure through a community-based program planning process. So I want to thank all of you for being a part of this panel. And what we're going to try to do is cover three main subjects tonight: the effects and statistics of anti-Asian hate incidents, history in this country about the hatred towards Asians, which the Congresswoman touched on as well, and the reaction, advocacy work, and resources for people who encounter anti-Asian incidents. And we're all struck by all the incidents that have been taking place. I think not most recently, one of the most recent ones, I think, is a 61-year-old gentleman up in East Harlem who was attacked, who is in serious condition right now. And it is a tragic, tragic attack and event that's taken place. So I'll throw it open to the panel as far as how you want to start, and then we'll take it from there. So, with the Deputy Commissioner, since I read your name first, why don't we start with you? I know the habit of muting. I do it all the time.
My apologies.
No. No apologies necessary.
So the question is, how do we handle such a situation? Is that it? How does the Commission handle that?
Sure, by all means.
So I think one thing about the Commission that everyone needs to know is that it addresses the New York City human rights law, which is actually a civil law, which protects all New Yorkers who are either living in New York City, visiting New York City, working in New York City. It covers all of us. And so we really should know this law really well. And the way it protects us is, one of the things I will talk about is the bystander training that you were talking about. So bystanders have a key way of addressing the situation. Of course, people who are victims of crimes can come to us, if they're bias or discrimination, they can come to us and file a complaint with us or just give us a tip, and the commission itself can investigate it. But I'll talk a little bit about the bystander interventions. So the Law Enforcement Bureau is charged with enforcing the New York City human rights law. But people contact us all the time to tell us about different types of incidents that have happened. One recent one was where someone contacted us and said that they were at a fingerprinting company, and they saw that an Asian family had come in and were trying to get fingerprinted for whatever reasons. And the person who was at the door basically told them they couldn't come in. They couldn't understand them. They needed to get somebody who translated for them, although they were speaking in English, and were very rude and asked them to just kind of leave and would not give them any service. a manager came out and said the same thing. So that family did not come forward and contact us, but the bystanders who were there in that same office saw what was happening, contacted us, and we as the commission are taking action on that issue without even knowing who that family was who came forward. Our Community Relations Bureau does a lot of work within the community, as you know. Our commission staff speak 31 different languages. We do training in Chinese and Fujianese and Korean. But, you know, when the Community Relations Bureau, when the incident happened in Midtown, if you remember the woman who was attacked and no one would go to help her, our commission went out and did a day of action. So we went out and informed people in the neighborhood about our law and what kind of protections it gives us, and asked about 100, and we got about 150 businesses to agree to stand up against hate and put up those posters so that we got community involvement in that. We also do a lot of anti-hate trainings. I think we're doing some with the Queensborough Public Library. And with other organizations. So I let others speak about the work that they do.
So I want to go back to the Congresswoman for a second while we have her. Can you tell us about the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act and the importance of that act and what it actually means in advocating against hate crimes?
So this legislation just passed the Senate last week, and hopefully we'll get through the House in the next few weeks. And President Biden has already said he would sign it. This bill does a few things. One, providing more funding to local community groups, like the commissioner, and like we've talked about, many of our community groups have been on the front lines and quite frankly doing the work that government probably should have been doing, from providing resources in different languages to literally providing PPE and, you know, helping with testing and so many things that people needed help with during this pandemic. It would require the Department of Justice to actually have someone who's reviewing these cases, who's paying attention to them, who's collecting the data. Right now, the way that local law enforcement entities report and investigate these incidents are really done on a case-by-case basis. It depends what the district attorney locally wants to do and how much motivation they have to even merely look into a case. And also, we want to make it easier for victims to be able to report these incidents, hopefully online and in multiple languages, is what is the outcome that we're hoping for. And finally, to provide counseling for people who are convicted of hate crimes. We don't want to just, like the DA said, prosecute and hate crime our way out of this. That's not the end-all be-all of how we're going to solve this problem.
Is this the piece of legislation that only had one negative vote?
Yes, 94-1, yeah.
94-1. All right, just as a reminder to the people who are watching, this is the one they can do the research on who the one vote was. But it had only one vote that was a no. So, and tell us the difference between, and educate me as far as the difference between what a hate crime is and a hate incident is, and how we distinguish between the two.
So the statutes are different state by state, but it largely is dependent on the intention of the perpetrator, which, as we know, is often hard to prove. Like, did they use a racial slur before they physically attack someone, during or after? And so, you know, this is part of the reason why we also think that local law enforcement would benefit from more guidance. So if you remember the cases in Atlanta, you know, at first glance, the sheriff just chalked it up to the perpetrator having a bad day. Now, we've been saying it wasn't just a bad day. We want you and the prosecutor to investigate the perpetrator's emails, his history. You can't just take his word for it that he had a bad day. And we actually took the route of, when I went down to Atlanta, of driving from the first attack to the last two attacks. Very complicated, windy path that took almost an hour. It was not by coincidence. And so we need them to investigate, you know, more effectively to find out what the intentions might have been.
And again, for both the congresswoman, but the entire group, tell us what really happened to make the increase just so dramatic over the last year. Obviously, the pandemic, I would imagine a lot of the politics on a national level. But are there other things that you would attribute to this serious increase in the number of attacks that have taken place?
Well, if I may, I think it's a confluence of various things. There has historically been many, many incidents through our country's history where Asian Americans, Asians have been specifically targeted, excluded, and scapegoated. And this is just a continuation of that very long history. It did not help that the past administration specifically blamed the Asians for this virus and the serious consequences that all of us have suffered. It's very easy for someone like Donald Trump to demonize the Chinese because, again, we look different. And that has happened historically as well with respect to not just us, but with the Indian populations, the Filipinos, the Japanese, and so on. And what happened culturally over the past 4 years was the opening up the doors of allowing people to say and act in hateful ways. Society was no longer demonstrating from the point of view of our leadership that this kind of behavior was unacceptable. And I believe then that the floodgates were opened. But again, demonizing China, making it a political enemy in terms of every aspect, and it's just another piece of wood in that fueled the fire. So again, it's a confluence of things.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what Joyce is describing in terms of really putting this in historical context and being careful not to just, pin the blame on former President Trump alone. Really he was emblematic of an administration and a policy that had weaponized a lot of policy against immigrant communities more generally, and then became much more targeted specifically against Chinese and Americans, Chinese and Asian Americans. But what I also wanted to just really emphasize, I think, as a part of that confluence is really the economic uncertainty and recession and how, people across the city and the country are experiencing that. And we've seen in particular, a scapegoating of Asian Americans during periods of American history when there was, either real or not perceived economic strife and transition, dating back from the late 1800s. The passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which specifically called out Chinese Americans for exclusion, was a response to white laborers complaining about declining wages and not, having enough jobs. But that's been true for Sikh Americans also who've immigrated to the country of being chased by white mobs out of towns because they were perceived as taking jobs away from, white laborers. And so that's been unfortunately a common experience for Asian Americans. I think just remembering the disproportionate impact of COVID on our communities, it's been shared by Asian Americans, but I think that experience has actually been pretty invisible until now. And it's only until we hear, for example, the story of the man who was attacked in East Harlem, the fact that he was displaced by a fire in Chinatown, had lost his job, was collecting cans as a way of trying to get by. I mean, that's a really stark sort of description of the kind of economic pain and distress that, so many Asian Americans and other communities of color have experienced. I would say arguably because the federal government did not respond quickly enough during the Trump administration and really focusing resources, where it was needed.
So I want to pick up on the word weaponizing as well, because I think listening to what you just said, what the Congresswoman said earlier around, the attacks that have been taking place historically, and also Joyce talked about as far as the historical attacks, but it really had been underground for the general population per se, and not necessarily as broadly known as what's happening right now. And did the weaponizing both legitimize that in the minds of some? Okay, this is, we're able to do this now because people have been given permission to attack. It feeds into the ignorance. It feeds into what people don't know. Has that really confluence that Joyce talked about really taken place to the point where it's going to be difficult to then re-engage to make sure that it doesn't take place as we move forward?
You know, I don't think so. I think that there is a national awakening in terms of the disparities that many of the communities of color face, including the Asian American community. No one could turn away from what happened to George Floyd, as horrible as that was to witness. I think it came out loud and clear that there is true injustice in this country. And I think it's coming out loud and clear that there is also true injustice with respect to the Asian American and other communities. What I believe is happening is that we're beginning to understand that each one of us has experienced these kinds of actions against us historically. And one of the things that I find is that it is eye-opening when many of us learn our history. For example, Black lives matter more if you understand that if your heritage was Italian, your ancestors were lynched, and someone like Teddy Roosevelt said it was a good idea. You know, Italians at that point were treated as subhuman, hang them. And there were innocent people that were hung for something that wasn't done. And you see other situations of a similar nature. Just think about John Kennedy, who people revere. John Kennedy's patriotism was questioned because he was Irish Catholic. Do people remember that? If we know one another's history, it becomes easier for us to understand that we must stand up for each other. And that is not to say that we are dismissing someone else's difficult experience. For example, for you to say, my grandparents went through something just like that and we did okay, that's not the response. The response is, I'm sorry your grandparents went through that. We should be standing up for one another. And I think that this has opened up an opportunity for that dialogue.
Deputy Commissioner?
So I would just add something that, you know, I'm concentrating a lot on the hate crimes that we see happen on the street, but both of us experience discrimination on a daily basis, so either where we work or where we are, when we use the store or the doctor's office or in our housing, when we are looking for housing. It's just important to remember that discrimination can happen on so many levels, and it's not necessarily because somebody commits a violent crime. And that is what we need. We need to change how, where we live, where we work, and where, what we do. That's where we go. So, you know, something like human rights, I'll come back to it, actually. So, just think it's important to keep in mind that rather than only concentrate. We should think about the incidents that are happening on the street. But that's not the only way to flood the discrimination.
Jennifer, I see you nodding your head, so I want to pick up on.
Well, yeah, I think just the idea of, on one hand, personal experiences are really powerful ones, right, that either reinforce our experience of racism or that give us hope that that's, you know, not that we each have an impact through our actions and behaviors and our willingness to have an uncomfortable conversation with a neighbor. You know, to ask questions or to interrupt if they are saying something that is racist or harmful. And it starts at that level, to the neighborhood level, where, you know, community organizations like AFI are thinking about what are the ways in which, especially around public space, we can bring people together to, again, create shared experiences of people working side by side, cleaning up their neighborhoods, cleaning up public spaces. You know, really building those personal experiences of solidarity, but in that personal way of working together, enjoying the city together, I think are really powerful. And then at a policy level, I think what Sapna was getting me to think about is, you know, we've had an effective policy of housing segregation and school segregation, right? That has certainly, I think, contributed to a lot of the polarization of communities. And so the hard work of really reversing those types of policies are more important than ever. Just thinking about the next mayor and the continued work of our democracy.
So let me pick up on that, because in addition to the policy that you're talking about and how we have to go forward, a lot of it also revolves around community organizing as well and working side by side. And I've heard that theme come up. Can you talk a little bit about the community organizing that you have seen in your respective roles, both as public people, but also in your private world, in your respective communities, and how that community organizing plays such an important next step in bringing communities together? Jennifer, why don't you start and I'll just
go
around.
Yeah, I can share certainly about, you know, the history of the organization that I co-lead, Asian Americans for Equality, is one that really, I think, illustrates the Asian American movement and community organizing in the city. The Asian American movement was inspired by the Black Liberation Movement, the anti-war movement, and Third Liberation Movements of the 1960s and 70s, where it was very intentional. You know, groups of students, I think, you know, had a greater awareness of their identity and really wanted to reject being described as Orientals. You know, they said, we're not Oriental rugs to be stepped on. We are Asian Americans. But it was also a call to bring, you know, Asian ethnic groups together in solidarity within our community, but also to link arms with Black and Latinx communities too, to fight for housing justice, economic justice. So here, you know, in New York City, AFI, you know, founded as an organization really to fight for labor rights first. You know, when one of the largest residential projects in Chinatown, Confucius Plaza, was being built, the construction, you know, supervisors excluded Chinatown workers from being able to work in their own neighborhood and building a residential project in their neighborhood. So AFI was founded around labor organizing, but then also quickly saw the need to really fight for better housing conditions and affordable housing. So that's very much an example of, I think, the power of community residents recognizing when there is a need and when government resources are not coming in to improve lives, of really, you know, taking sort of their destiny within their own hands and really believing in the power of people coming together to make a positive change. And I think a lot of the positive community development that we've seen in Chinatowns and other neighborhoods across the city are a direct result of the labor and love of a lot of community organizers.
If you saw a little smile that crossed my face, remind me when AFI was
in 1974.
And I just for some reason, I remember it clearly in my prior life being engaged with AFI in a number of projects when I was the head of the New York Urban League. And so there was a lot of partnership work there as well. So
yeah, our founders, I would say, sorry to interrupt,
but
that's
a really
important point. I mean, one, it's just notable too that the founders of AFI are all strong women. So I've got to acknowledge that too, that we have a deep tradition of strong women leadership in our organization and our movement generally, but also the real partnership and the fact that we learned about community organizing, the effectiveness of doing that really from Black communities and Black groups in the city. And so that's something that is very much a part of our tradition and DNA.
Joyce, so are you about to?
Yeah, it's interesting. At CUNY, we issued a report in 2016 indicating that there was no Asian American representation at the highest levels of leadership within CUNY. We had 20 plus campuses, not a single Asian American president on any of the campuses, and so on. And so I think as a direct result of our work and calling those issues to people's awareness, we finally did get two Asian Americans appointed as president of campuses at CUNY. And this is really important because it is at those levels that issues that impact Asian Americans, for example, are talked about. And if we are not at the table, they're not discussed. That impacts whether or not there's Asian American studies at these campuses that help to educate our own community members, our students coming through the education system, as well as other communities. So that, again, we learn about one another and our common histories. You know, Jennifer mentioned the importance of the Black movement. for Asian Americans in their own shaping of their own movement. And that's very much the case. The Japanese internment, when Japanese American citizens were rounded up and put into internment camps, was a major turning point in terms of having the Japanese Americans, prominent Japanese Americans, joining the support of the civil rights movement in the 60s, because they began to understand and see oppression in ways that had directly impacted their families. So again, throughout history, we've seen these kinds of situations where communities of color have worked together, have learned from one another. The NAACP sent representatives to visit those internment camps and came back and reported about the conditions and how dismal they were, and that there were the elderly and babies that were dying from the heat in those internment camps. They gave voice to what was happening to Japanese Americans at the time. And in return, many of the people that grew up in that situation came back and supported the Black movements. And so again, if we don't know these histories, we think that we are traveling this road alone. And we're not. We have all walked along a certain part of that road to becoming Americans. And if we understood that piece, it would really go a long way.
Before I get to the Deputy Commissioner, I would just want to pick up something you said, Joyce, and that the issue of CUNY, but I want to break it down low CUNY to our high schools and middle schools and elementary schools. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the teaching of some of the history, legislation, discrimination that took place in the past and what it means? Are the schools doing enough beyond the CUNY system, but when you go through K through 12, as far as the history is concerned and what it means in building an understanding and making sure that society has that same foundation to understand that they are going down the same roads and have some of the same challenges. So Joyce, do you think of you?
Yeah, I think that it is imperative that we teach American history, which is inclusive of all Americans. I don't believe that the education system is doing that now, either at the K through 12 level or at the levels of higher education. Asian American studies is something we've struggled for 50 years at CUNY. It has never gotten the kinds of resources and support that it needs. We educate more than 21% of the teachers in the state of New York, and I dare say a much larger percentage of that for teaching in the public schools of New York City. And people have not been exposed to these things. I can tell you myself growing up, by the way, I'm the fourth generation of my family in the United States. When somebody tells me to go back to China, it's very weird. Mm. But I will tell you, the first time I ever saw a picture of Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung was in the centerfold of a Black Panther paper. I went to high school in a place that was predominantly African-American. I sat next to Julius Irving's younger brother in homeroom. And my older brother sat next to Julius Irving in homeroom.
That must have been Roosevelt.
That was Roosevelt, exactly. And that's where I graduated. And I must tell you that the experience opened my eyes in many ways. I had African-American classmates that said, Joyce, where are you from? And I would say New York City, because I was born and raised in the Lower East Side. And they say, no, before that. And I would say, well, my family came from China, if that's what you mean. And they said, oh, okay, and so you were born here. I said, yes. Then I said, where are you from? And they said, the South. And then I said, where did you come from before the South? And my African-American friend said, I don't know. And that's when I began to realize that in order for enslavement to happen, their identities, their culture, anything that made them strong, resilient, and able to resist had to be ripped away from them in order for them to be enslaved. And later on, when I saw Jesse Jackson running for president and using the phrase African-American, my sense was, okay, we're getting closer, but it's an entire continent. I could tell you what village my family came from. Mm-hmm. I can tell you what little hut my great-grandfather came from. I could tell you about the tree in the center of the village where all the grandmas sat while the grandchildren ran around. and that was taken away. And so I think that, again, that made me value my own culture, my own education more, and it made me see how all of this is so important for us to be able to move forward together as people.
Deputy Commissioner?
So, I mean, the commission, as I said before, the commission's Community Relations Bureau does a lot of work with the community. A lot of bystander intervention training.
Deputy Commissioner, one second. Joyce, can you put yourself on mute? Because I think that may be drowning out the deputy when she's speaking.
So, you know, the commission in the last year started a COVID response team because we started getting so many calls about and inquiries about the types of discrimination that were happening in the city. We have done about 36 different bystander intervention trainings. We've done bias and hate crime reporting town halls in Korean and Chinese and Japanese. And so, I mean, that's one way to reach out to the community, but I agree with Joyce and with Jennifer that one way that the only way we can all live together is to learn that we all have shared experiences, that we all in one way or another, no matter what race we are and what religion we are, at some point, someplace, we're treated as if we are different. You know, it may be when we go to another country, maybe while we are here. And the only way we can learn to live together is to understand that we are all alike in so many ways.
So I want to talk about stereotypes for a second. I think some of you have touched on it, and stereotypes both through ignorance, through the perpetuation of certain images in media and how that's been reinforcing stereotypes from the past and even until this day, which then feeds in to the environment of the attacks as well. Have there been any active movements within the Asian American PI community around old TV shows and movies that reinforce negative stereotypes so that way people are still seeing those negative images? Have there been any attempts to address that at all?
I think that there have been attempts. I know that within the academic arena, people have talked about these issues. Some of the more prominent actors and actresses of Asian heritage are speaking out against those kinds of issues as well. And, you know, it's interesting. It's the exporting of these images of people of color in this country that is causing some issues overseas. People come here from other countries, for example, without having met people from these various communities, not having worked side by side with them, as Jennifer mentioned. And as a result, these negative stereotypes have been exported and have an impact on us as well. But yes, there are movements. I would not say that they are large and formal, but people don't hesitate to call it out when they see it.
Yeah, I would add that I think more recently, I think there's more activism, media activism, to really, I think, call out, you know, the racial stereotyping of Asian Americans in popular culture. I don't think it's been as organized and probably as sustained in the same way that we've seen in the Black community, for example. But I think there's an increasing awareness of just how important culture is, you know, either positive culture or negative culture in really shaping people's beliefs and norms. You know, going back to the first point that you were making, you know, Dennis, about sort of the normalization of racism and scapegoating that happened, you know, over the last 4 years. But I think also what's been encouraging to see is not only sort of a rejection of stereotyping, but also Asian Americans play a more active role in the cultural production, right? Of really taking a more of a determined role in telling our stories. And, you know, in a staff meeting that we had in our organization to give space to our staff to really process, you know, the murders of the women in Atlanta and sort of the escalation of anti-Asian hate, a lot of staff remarked that what they've seen differently in this moment is that they are speaking up as a part of the younger generation, but also their parents and encouraging parent and grandparents in the process of having conversations, you know, with my mom, for example, who's 74, and urging her to be more careful, to not see friends, unfortunately, if she has to take the subway. It's also it's an opening for us to talk about what she's experiencing and to understand that sort of in a larger context, and for her, you know, to express a range of emotions that she's feeling about this. And so I think that's been a very important change.
Since you raised your mother, though, talk to me then about the generational response to what's taken place, because I would imagine there are probably a range of emotions. Obviously, people are angry and they're upset and scared as well. But are there some generational issues that any of you see that we need to talk about that have to be addressed?
Well, I think a very fundamental one is speaking up, right? That if they've experienced verbal or physical harassment, shaming, to actually talk about it. That I think is still sometimes a very big barrier sometimes within, you know, our family structures and our culture. So I think just even talking about it, sharing it, that's hard. And that's why I think the real emphasis on, you know, reporting is so important, but it's a very big challenge to overcome.
You know, in terms of generations, it also has to do with how long families have been here. You know, in a family like mine, where three generations could not become U.S. citizens because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, they don't feel that they're part of this country, and they also don't feel that anything they have to say matters to anyone. Even my generation, having been born here and here 60-plus years, grew up believing that we were not American because we were told we were not American. And based on the experiences of our parents, our grandparents, and great-grandparents, we did not belong here. This newer generation, however, is beginning to see things differently. And sometimes I attribute it to the fact that they're immigrants. Part of that is that they come here from a country which is considered a superpower. When I was growing up, the history of China was sick man of Asia, overcome by the British, subject to the Opium War, back to Western civilization. And so we were small in numbers. There were only 105 Chinese, for example, being allowed into this country up until 1965 when the immigration laws changed. So it's taken a long time for the community, I think, to coalesce. And also for this sense of pride of the Asian communities now, people coming from Korea, et cetera, feeling that, you know what, I am not going to allow myself to be victimized in speaking up. So there is a very large generational difference. I mean, my mom is 20 years older than Jennifer's. My mother would say, don't do anything. They don't care about you. Don't say anything. It's only going to get you into trouble. You'll get attacked more. And that's a very different conversation. And the 20-year difference between her mom and mine is based on the experiences they've had.
Well, also to break down what you just said around the generational difference, say, of your mother versus Jennifer's mother, I would imagine they would also say, I'm not going to report it. I'm not going to call in what's happened to me. So it's been staying underground more than anything else versus now.
Not to report
Okay.
because
it's
trouble for the family.
Right, exactly. So that way it's like, don't bring shame or something I don't want us involved in. They don't think highly of us anyway, so why should I put myself out there? So having said that, Deputy Commissioner, it falls back to you in the Commission on Human Rights. How do you pull that information? How do you get that information and then develop an action plan to respond to some of the things that may stay somewhat below the surface aside from what you may see, you know, in the news media? Talk about that role.
Right. So the news media is important, but, you know, different ways that people come to us is either they file a complaint with us, they call us and give us a tip. If they want to remain anonymous and they don't want to put their name out there, we understand. And we will investigate without them having given us their name and contact information. Sometimes they're willing to give us their name and contact information, but don't want to file a complaint. So that kind of helps us to reach out to them, talk to them a little bit more about what happened, and then decide how the commission will handle the situation. So we haven't, as the commission itself is concerned, done anything with the systemic and the stereotyping that we are talking about. But I'll talk a little bit about actions we brought against Prada and Gucci and Dior because of advertising and merchandising that they had. Prada and Gucci because they had merchandising that had blackface, And the commission itself brought an action against them saying, you cannot do this. You have to understand that this is offensive and you need to take this off the market. You need to understand the history of a country and wherever you are, you know, merchandising, marketing all this stuff. And you need to change the way you design and market things, right? When it came to Dior, it was, Native Americans who were in a ad that was called Savage for a perfume that's called Savage. And so we intervened and said, you cannot do this. You cannot have an ad like this. So if there are things out there that you think are stereotyping and offensive, I would love to hear about them and have longer conversations, not just with the both of you, but if there are people in the community who would reach out to us, I would be happy to have a longer conversation because there are things we can do to change things on the ground, to have them sign an order with us saying that they will change the way they do it. Prada and Gucci actually set up scholarships to work with communities of color. And then they, you know, change their design and marketing strategy. So, you know, things can change if we work together to make sure that people don't understand, they will make mistakes. And then we need to reach out and say, you can't do that. This is a violation of the law and you can't discriminate.
I tell you, the beauty of, unfortunately, being on these platforms all the time over the last year, you become sensitive to the body language. Normally you would see that body language in person. So Jennifer, I'm watching your head nod. So I'm going to throw it back to you because I see that you definitely have responded to what the deputy commissioner was saying.
Well, I think it was actually an earlier point that the commissioner made that I thought was an important one maybe to reinforce, which is the importance of bystanders also of speaking up, right? Because just imagining that there's so many victims, unfortunately, because of language barriers, the trauma that they've experienced, you know, the reticence to report or say anything. There's so many reasons why a victim might not want to report something. But just, I've been guilty of this where I've witnessed a car accident, let's say a minor, you know, sort of bumper, you know, collision. But, you know, I'll look around and it looks as if there are other witnesses that are closer to the incident. And so I sort of make a judgment that, oh, they don't need me. They don't need me to report what I've seen. But I share that to say that actually I have a heightened understanding and I think sense of responsibility that I would urge amongst all of us that if we were in a situation, unfortunately, where we do witness something, it is so important then for us to stay there and to report it and to share that or to call it in later. You know, if we can't stay there, what I understand is with the DA's office, you can call what you've witnessed and report that in later. But that will help then with, you know, gathering evidence, especially if there's been a hate crime. I understand that it's very, very important, very hard to prove. And so the more that bystanders, you know, and witnesses actually speak up, the more that can help.
Can you talk a little bit about the bystander training? Because I know we've been doing it here at the library, but if you can really talk about what it actually means for the community and the empowerment of not just the Asian American community, but communities overall working together. So I would throw that out to any of you as far as talking about the bystander training itself. Jennifer?
Yeah, so I've participated in one on my own from an organization called Hollaback, which has been offering a lot of these trainings for individuals and for organizations and employers. And in fact, our staff recently, our social service staff, went through retraining, a self-defense training. And so we're organizing these, you know, for staff and for residents, and a number of organizations across the city are doing the same. They're important because it gives you an opportunity to actually practice actually speaking up because, you know, you don't realize until you're in that moment sometimes that you might freeze up. And so actually, you know, practicing saying something to be disruptive, to interrupt is actually very, very important to do before you find yourself in a situation like that, or to kind of consider different options for, you know, creating a distraction that can create some sense of safety. So I think they are valuable for giving really practical sort of tools and tips that you can do without putting yourself in harm's way.
Joyce?
Oh, sorry, I couldn't unmute for a second there.
That's okay.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the bystander training, I think it is important to take the formal training before you engage in a way where you're trying to be helpful to somebody who's being targeted. So I would say that in terms of that, take the formal training. But also understand that simply doing something like checking with the person that was just attacked, if the perpetrator leaves, to see how they're doing, staying with them until the police come, you know, or even just the simple act of doing things like checking in on a neighbor, checking in on a store merchant or business owner that you've interacted with for many years in your neighborhood, all of those things will help to give them a sense of being supported. I think that it will give them a sense of community. And oftentimes it may lead to them agreeing to report something that they might otherwise have not wanted to report because they feel that they have that support. So, you know, I'm a big supporter of the bystander training, but I'm saying engage in the training. Don't put yourself in harm's way, as Jennifer said. I've seen people just look at the 5 D's and think that they can do something. No, go through the whole program.
Deputy Commissioner, I saw you nodding your head as well.
Yeah, I mean, our commission actually offers the bystander training. I would recommend that everybody take it. I agree that people should take the training before they jump in and try to do something and put themselves in harm's way. And I can't agree more that if you can't do anything, you should at least be there to support the person who has been attacked. And, you know, once the perpetrator has left, to be there to support them and to wait until maybe the cops come or, you know, they are able to walk away by themselves. So I think all those things are important.
You know, as we move towards the closing hour of this great discussion, talk to me about the role of community-based organizations, because I think a lot of the work that we've talked about, and we talked about it earlier, as far as partnerships are concerned, but the empowerment, the engagement of community-based organization and what it means as far as addressing this serious issue.
Yeah, I can start to say, you know, there have been community organizations that have definitely come together, I think, in this moment, both within the city and across the country, really, you know, to learn from each other in terms of how we can really increase community safety at the neighborhood and community level, because we do want to be thoughtful about doing that in a way that does not invite more a police presence and policing in our neighborhoods or in other communities of color. And so what that looks like is, you know, it's a lot of volunteer-driven organizing of residents and New Yorkers, both, you know, in neighborhoods like Chinatown and across the city to begin to organize safety patrols to make sure that people who need, you know, a walk to or from the subway to run daily errands, they have somebody who can walk them to do that safely. So we're seeing, you know, quick mobilization of volunteers to really support in that way. We're also involved in a fundraiser like many others in fundraising for personal safety alarms that we can, you know, distribute to seniors, women, and essential workers, you know, small business owners in our neighborhoods. So, you know, those are examples of things that we're doing. We also talked about, you know, sort of neighborhood cleanups, you know, doing community building around public spaces. I think that will be even more important as the city continues to open up and, you know, there's a more activity coming into public spaces. There's more opportunities and to really bring communities together. And I'll say just maybe on a systemic level, you know, I have to say from a community development perspective, it's also, I think, you know, acknowledging the work of communities working, you know, across racial lines to fight for, you know, more resources like rental housing assistance, preventing the eviction of too many, right, from unstable housing, fighting for quality jobs, fighting for a care infrastructure. That's been something really exciting, I think, to see from a policy level. It's a recognition of our essential workers. And so I think that touches upon all of our communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. And so it's remembering also the long fight for resources that our neighborhoods deserve.
Joyce, look like you.
Yeah, I would agree and echo everything that Jennifer said, but I think the key role for the community-based organizations is to keep this issue front and center and not allow it to wither away. What we need is a sustained focus on these issues because, again, those resources will not come to our communities without this sustained spotlight. You know, we are nearly 16% of New York City's population, and yet we've received less than 2% of the contracts, for example, from the city until recently when there's been a big push. And we have to sustain that push because our population is growing. And our needs have not been addressed at all in many sectors, you know, in social services, education, and so on. The language is itself a big issue because the Asian American community is so diverse. It's not a single community. Just look at the three of us on this the panel and the differences. You know, Jennifer and I may be both Chinese, but our families probably come from completely different parts of China, and our families probably speak completely different dialects. So that, you know, although the written language would be the same. And certainly Sapna comes from a different part of Asia, or her family comes from a different part of Asia.
Also, I just take a look at my team here at the Queens Public Library and the diversity of people from various backgrounds who some people externally may lump together, but in reality, they're not from the same province or speak the same language. And, you know, having that understanding and education for the general public, I think, is so important. I want to ask one other question. I mean, we've touched on it, but I want to do a little bit deeper dive on it. Talk about what you're hearing from the people in the community, your colleagues, fear, scared, I'm not going out. I mean, because we touched on it, but I really want to give people a real sense of what people are feeling out there. So I throw it open to the three of you to respond to that.
You know,
Joyce, you went mute again. Joyce?
Okay, I'm sorry. Some of the things that I am hearing are truly heartbreaking. My own grandson, now he is the sixth generation of my Chinese-American family in the United States. He said to me, do I have to change the way I look? In other words, he is now assuming a sense that there's something wrong with him. And I've said, no, it's not your problem. It is their problem. And I was just on a Zoom panel this afternoon where a professor tells me that she is, you know, she happens to be Japanese American. She is grateful that we still have to wear masks because she's able to pull the mask up high, put on a pair of sunglasses and a hat. And she hopes that somebody will not recognize the fact that she's Asian because she's afraid of being attacked. But I don't want to focus just on the fear that the community feels and the sense, in some ways, for young people, misunderstanding what's happening, the sense of shame, etc. I think what we need to focus on is the amazing resilience of the community. This community has come back and has battled, and they have learned and understood and learned to accept allyship and to form allyship with others and to support others. I think that that's the message we need to focus on. It's not that we're just victims. We are targeted, but we're fighting back. And I think that this is a trend that I will not see diminish. I'm very proud of the community in many ways. But just think about that child who is concerned that maybe there's something wrong with him because of what's happening.
Very powerful. Deputy Commissioner?
So we are, as you all may have heard, we are all supposed to be going back to work as city workers in May. And the way it's come to us is so many of our staff are afraid of what's going to happen. You know, there are concerns. I don't want to say that they're necessarily afraid, but there are serious concerns about taking the subway and coming to work. And it's understandable, you know, why they would be concerned about that. So that's one way that I've seen, like, among the staff, while we're trying to figure out who comes in when, we're all coming in on staggered schedules. you know, people are thinking of bringing their cars in rather than driving their cars in, rather than taking the subway in. It's just, it's heartbreaking in some ways that people are so concerned about just coming to work and going back from work.
Jennifer, I'll give you the last word before I close. Jennifer.
Yeah, although I really liked the way that, you know, Joyce, I think, emphasized the resilience of our communities and how, you know, on one hand, our staff are very apprehensive about coming back to our social service offices in Chinatown, the Lower East Side, Jackson Heights and Flushing, for example. You know, they're worried about taking the subway, and I understand why. You know, just recently I heard from the CFDA about how they were contacted by garment factories because garment factory staff and garment workers are being physically assaulted on a regular basis when they come out of the subway in Midtown Manhattan. So unfortunately, this is almost a daily occurrence for people who are just trying to get to work. And so there is a real economic harm, you know, that is being inflicted on families who are already struggling and on the brink of homelessness, you know, through the emergency cash assistance that we distributed during the peak of the pandemic. We heard from too many households where women were widowed because they lost partners to COVID and now had to return to work to try to support their families. You know, there are immigrant high school students who are now working part-time because their parents have lost jobs or lost hours. And we also have heard a lot about immigrant students also not returning to school, even given the choice, right, to have in-person instruction. And so just thinking about the social and mental health that that's going to have an impact on for young people and old people. You know, thinking about my independent mother who I've now said she can't visit the neighbor in Harlem or the neighbor or the friend, I mean, you know, in Brooklyn because I'm apprehensive about her safety. Well, that means she's very isolated then, and the independence that she's very proud of, you know, has been severely diminished. So those are the small ways and big ways in which I think our communities are being impacted. But all that said, I think, you know, for those of us who work in some shape or form in or, you know, in support of Asian American communities, I think there's a doubling down of just wanting to speak up, to stand up and do our part. And I think encouraging all New Yorkers to do the same.
So I want to thank all of you for educating me, educating our audience, empowering us to think about ways we can play a role to address this and also to build all the resiliency that you've talked about as well, and what the communities represent throughout the city and working together. I want to thank the DA as well as Congresswoman Meng for their participation earlier in the program. Most importantly, I say to all of you, we are here for you at the Queens Public Library in whatever ways you feel we can be of help and assistance, and I thank you for your participation. With that being said, thank you to all who are watching, and have a safe and a good evening. Good night.